This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rapp, and editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. This week, I'm joined by Xander Riggs, editor of this podcast and comic books at Destroy the Cyborg, and Paul Jaisley, staff writer for comic books at Destroy the Cyborg. We're all from Destroy the Cyborg. Who'd have thought? How are you guys doing this week? How have comic books been?
I assume they've been good. I haven't really read a lot this past week. Didn't make it to the shop. I know, I didn't really have much to pull. Most of my free time has been taken up by the New Japan Pro Wrestling G1 Climax, the big 3-week-long wrestling tournament that's taking place right now. So that's kind of where all my attention's been.
Dude, that sounds so
week.
Cool.
Oh, it's
that
the
sounds
best.
Like, are they fighting on Mount Fuji? Like, I can only imagine that they're fighting on Mount Fuji.
The finals take place on top of Mount, yeah. No, it's a pretty exciting wrestling tournament just started this past week. So I'm trying to stay up on that because that's my other great love besides comics is professional wrestling. But the one thing I did read this week that I kind of want to share and mention, some old back issues I found a while ago at my comic shop. It's a 4-issue miniseries called Cinder and Ash that DC published back in 1988. It's written by Jerry Conway, amazing art by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, and it's sort of like a political thriller, detective story, Vietnam War comic all wrapped into one about a partnership. Jacob Ash, who was a Vietnam Marine, and a sort of orphan he takes under his wing named Cinder. The reason I bought it, though, is because Garcia Lopez, as an artist, are either of you really familiar with that name?
Sounds familiar.
I can't say that I am.
Well, it's interesting because he's worked for DC since the 80s, or maybe the late 70s, but he didn't do a lot of interior work. He didn't really had a big run on a title. He did all of their licensed artwork, so when you're in the store and you see a T-shirt or a lunchbox or action figure package that has the Justice League or DC characters on it, 9 times out of 10, it's based on his artwork or he did the artwork for it. Even though he didn't do a lot of comic book interiors, more people have probably seen his artwork than have ever read, you know, Watchmen or whatever. So it's pretty amazing, you know, the influence that his art has had. So I grabbed this because I wanted to see his interior work, and it's great. He's a fantastic artist. So I think they just republished this as a trade a few years ago. So I would recommend tracking it down. Cinder and Ash. I really enjoyed it.
Cinder and Ash. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. How about you, Xander?
I've sort of been falling behind on a lot of the series I've been reading. I most recently this week have been trying to catch up on Injection, which is real heavy stuff. I think I've read the 3 issues that are out. It is only 3 issues that are out, right? I haven't fallen even farther behind, have I?
Yeah, I think you're fine. Yeah.
But that series is just one of, like, it's not that it's necessarily dense, because not a whole lot happens, but the dialogue is such that there's a lot to read into, and there's a lot of things that As an avid comic book reader, as an avid reader of specifically Warren Ellis titles, when I see certain key things in dialogue or in a scene, I sort of mentally tuck it away because I know this is going to be important later. So maybe it's just because of that, it feels like a really dense series so far.
Well, that's the thing about his books is you have to pay attention. You got to just start taking notes while you're reading his books. Like, when's this going to come up? Issue 48? Okay, that's a tie back to issue 2. Got it. Cool.
I gotta remember those notes. Ties all the way back to one line from issue 1.
Yeah.
So I read that, been reading that, and I actually picked up the first volume of Copperhead. I can't remember if I had mentioned that last time I was on the podcast, but the series Copperhead is, I think, one of my favorite now as far as sci-fi westerns have gone. Like, I haven't read too many sci-fi westerns, but it hit right in the spot where Firefly is.
Oh yeah.
And it's have either of you read Copperhead?
No, I haven't.
I've only read the first issue.
Okay. So it's about this woman, Sheriff Clara Bronson, who goes to Copperhead, this sort of podunk town on the outskirts of not only of the planet, but of sort of the universe. And she sort of assumes the role of sheriff in this town. And it's this really interesting story of a woman and her child trying to find their place in this new town, about trying to live amongst all of these different alien life forms, you take the lawlessness of the Old West and you throw it into the lawlessness of this border planet, and it draws all sorts of parallels that I just really love between modern day and historical events and sci-fi, and so it just hits a bunch of sweet spots for me.
Nice. Yeah, I've heard only positive things about that series. I think it's one of those books that I'm going to pick up and trade just because it looks so cool. Like, I see so many advertisements for it, so I'm like, man, that cover just looks so cool. And that's the thing. We've talked about this, you know, way back about how a cover can reel you in. And yeah. That's one of those books where I'm just like, space western, and there's like this weird alien guy, and who's this lady? Like, okay, let's do this. Let's try this for $10. Like, yeah. I'm all for it.
What have you been reading, Mike?
Oh, well, I managed to track down a copy of Frankenstein Underground #2, which I missed somehow. Like, between me moving from Grand Rapids to New York, #2 came out, and I forgot to grab it before I left, or it came out, like, the week I was moving. I didn't go to the comic shop, and then Midtown Comics sold out, and Forbidden Planet didn't have any copies, and I didn't want to buy it online. So I was kind of just hoping that maybe one day when I sit down to read the whole series, like, I'll find a copy of #2.
Maybe
so I went to Midtown
there.
This week, yeah, and I actually found a copy. I haven't read the series yet. Now I just stacked them all together. They're in my big to-read list. I think I've only really read my weekly books, so I read Wolf finally. I got a copy of It Will All Hurt #2, but I didn't get a copy of #1, so I got to find that. And I finally unpacked all of my trades that were in boxes and stuff.
Oh,
so now I've got a stack of like 20 trades that I need to read. So I haven't really done too much in terms of reading, but I've set out a plan to tackle all of the books that I have on top of all the digital stuff that I've been just like sitting on for a long time, like Forever Evil and Black Sad and all this stuff. So it's been interesting. But other than that, you know, I've just been hanging out. You know, my sister was in town this week, so I showed her around New York, and she did all the touristy things without me, which was nice. And
you just sent her off to do touristy things.
Yeah, in the morning she would just get up and she'd go, and then she'd come back. She'd look at all these things. I was like, yep, Becca, it's New York. And
wow, I've only been there for how many, like,
I've been
how
there
long?
For like 3 months.
And you're already jaded?
I'm already jaded. Yeah. It's so much easier to be jaded, not care, not get excited about anything, because then you're a real New Yorker.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep.
It's that desire to fit in. I think it's
yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. That's
and
horrible.
I have cats here now. That's the other thing. So last weekend I wasn't on the podcast because I was moving my cats from Michigan to New York, and that was a stressful, like, just personally stressful. No one else was stressed except for me. Like, I was just, like, worried that the cats were going to explode when we got too high up in the plane or something. And now they're here, and they're... all they want to do is be around me, and I'm like, it was so much better when you weren't here.
I got comics to read. I got work to do.
I got
New York
to do. Cats.
I got jaded to be.
Yeah. So, you know, not a lot of comics, but just a whole bunch of other stuff. But let's actually get into the real comic stuff, and we can talk about our picks for this week. So, Xander, what was your pick for this week?
My pick is Lazarus, #18. I believe it's #18. I've sort of been... like, I just, in my mind, it's not, I don't see it as, this is the issue that's coming out. I know that the comic is coming, and in my mind, I'm just like, Lazarus.
It's yeah. There's no number to it. It's
I don't
just
even know the number.
Of the story.
I just know what's happening, and I'm super pumped for it.
Yeah.
Because back in, I think it was the second story arc, was the story arc called The Lift, where they talk about the different casts of people within the world of the comic, and so it focuses more on the Waste and the Serfs in the series, which are basically, for the first arc, they're totally forgotten. They're basically considered like trash people, and all they do is like sort of feed off of the supplies that the families have. So they're sort of seen as parasites more than anything else. But then in the second arc, you get a story from the perspective of people who are considered waste, and they're going to this event called The Lift, where they could become serf. They could be given jobs to work for the family, and that would provide their families with food and medicine and all the things that everyone is wanting in order to live. So in the newest issue that's coming out, we have the character Forever, who is the Carlisle family's Lazarus, joining up with one of the characters.
Also the pro tag,
yes. And she's joining up with one of these characters from The Lift, who was given a job as, I guess, as a soldier for the Carlisle family. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an interesting mashup of characters. Hopefully we get to see the characters interact more and get sort of different viewpoints on the combative elements between the different families and from the different characters. So I'm looking forward a lot to seeing all these characters again, finally, after I think it's been several issues since we've seen these characters.
Yeah.
So, yeah, real pumped for it.
This is one of those books, man, that I really find myself wanting to go back and reread over and over just because there's so much depth to it. Like, Greg Rucka has sold his soul to make this series, and
yeah,
it is paying off. He's
put in so much work for this. Every time I read the back matter in the issues or look at his Tumblr page or any of the stuff he posts on Twitter, it's clear that he's not just writing this series because he's constantly doing research and he's posting all of these articles of things that are happening in real life that was speculative during the time when he was writing an issue or when he was planning out the series. So it's really interesting to see all of the work that he's put into it. And also Michael Lark, who does the art for the series, does a fantastic job of portraying just sort of the bleakness of this future, and it swings in everything from just sort of the dirtiness of the waste to just the super clean environments of the families. So it's a huge range that he's having to hit, and it's amazing because he hits it every time.
Oh yeah. Paul, what's your pick for this week?
My pick, well, it was tough to pick one this week. It's a pretty stacked week for me. Between the new issue of Casanova, new issue of Transformers versus G.I. Joe, of course. But the book I'm probably most excited for is Daredevil number 17 by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. I've really loved Mark Waid's work on Daredevil. It's interesting, Daredevil was always a character that I think I liked more in theory than in practice. Because I tried reading the Michael Bendis run. I read some of the Brubaker run, and they were fine. It just wasn't really my cup of tea. But when Waid started writing Daredevil, he gave it a much more classic superhero kind of feel, which clicked with me more.
Totally.
Than the gritty crime sort of stuff. And Chris Samnee he's peerless. I think he's one of the absolute best artists doing contemporary superhero comics right now. So I'm sad to see their series end. This is the penultimate issue. Number 18 will be the last issue in their run. But as per tradition, Mark Waid is leaving Matt Murdock in a pretty bad way before he leaves the title. That's just what you do when you're leaving Daredevil. You get screw him over and like, all right, now it's your turn to fix this mess. So
yeah.
not to give away, a spoiler, but the last issue sort of involved Matt Murdock, whose identity is now well known. He's relocated to San Francisco and has come out, and everyone knows that he's Daredevil. He made a deal with his biggest enemy. Oh. And you probably guess who that is. I mean, literally his biggest enemy. So obviously, I'm pretty sure that deal's going to blow up in Matt Murdock's face. But this has been the most consistently high-quality, entertaining superhero book I've read in a long time. So I'm excited to see how it ends. At the same time, kind of sad that it's going to end so soon.
Right.
And this is Mark Waid's series that they just renumbered and continued, right?
Yeah.
I was reading that before. Yeah.
Yeah, because it started with Paolo Rivera was doing art.
Oh my gosh,
Chris Samnee took over. And then, of course, once you relocated to San Francisco from New York, you have to renumber the series, right?
Yeah.
No one would understand a new status quo in the middle of a run. What? So, of course, it got renumbered. And don't worry, when 18 is done and a new writer takes over, it'll be a brand new number one, so you won't be confused at all.
I think this is going to be post-Secret Wars, though, right?
Yeah.
Oh, probably. Yeah. I think that's where I fell off, because I was reading Mark Waid's Daredevil, and I love it, but I think I fell off around issue like 20, 30 something, like right before that it renumbered. And I was at the time I was reading a bunch of other series. So I was like, it's renumbered. Is it the same? Do I need to read everything else? Can I start at number one? So I just kind of dropped it and I was like, I'll pick this up later. I'll come back for you.
You definitely should. Yeah. It was a nice way of doing the status quo change. Actually. It's like, he's in a new city. He's got a kind of a new cast of characters. He's got a new, approach. Everyone knows who he is. So it kind of made sense to renumber it, but yeah, okay. this current run, Mark Waid is just doing amazing stuff on this title.
Definitely. That's awesome. Well, my pick for this week is Rasputin number 7, which is probably the coolest, most interesting, under-the-radar book that Image is publishing right now. I summed it up in our notes, but I think Rasputin, the first 5 issues were all about Rasputin, the guy, like, way back in the day, you know, the dude who was, like, killed, shot, maimed, you know, all these things. They supposedly couldn't kill him, and he finally dies. And so after the first arc, I was kind of confused because the series was going to continue, but I had no idea at all. Like, I wasn't following any news, any previews or anything. I was like, the series is going to continue, but later, but they didn't say with what. And I thought it was going to be more of him in the past, more of something. So where the first arc was all about his origins, this second arc has been like a flash forward to modern day times, where I'm going to give away kind of what happened last month, but nonetheless, it's Rasputin is working with this new presidential candidate who he is, like, I think he's her campaign manager, and he essentially is there as, like, protection slash as a, like, a way for him to rise to power without being the face of power. And this series is so interesting because it takes all the elements that they set up in the first arc and applies them to modern day. So all of these, like, little folk tales, all these weird interactions that Rasputin had and with, like, his powers that he has in the book, quote-unquote powers that he has, and all the different, like, stuff that took place is now, like, finding, like, playing out, I guess, in the future. And they hint at the idea that this has been happening for years and years and years because Rasputin never died. Ooh. Despite what everyone thought. So
this isn't the presidential candidate is a different, it's like modern day? Because I haven't been reading the series. Is it modern day or is it following the...
It's modern day.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And so, I don't know, Riley Rossimo's art is the most perfect art you can find for this type of book. Like, there's grittiness, but then there's like beautiful color. I don't remember who colors this book. I didn't write that down. But the combination... $5 says it's Jordy Belair. but yeah, this book, like I said, it's very under the radar. It's a fantastic read. That first arc is some of the most riveting storytelling just because, like, you know the ending, but at the same time, like, they've changed the path and direction. They've added their own little folklore to it, and they've added their own little fictional history. And if you ever read the series Proof, which is by the same two guys, Riley Rossimo and Alex Gresham, I think is his name, they contrive this cool world, and I've said this before, about what if Bigfoot was like an actual federal agent hunting down other mythological creatures across the United States and the world. It's the funnest series. It's the most fun series you can read. I don't know. I love that book, and it was, unfortunately, I think it ended after like 22 issues or something, but it was a blast. And so to see these two guys together was what brought me to the series in the first place, and it is such a fun book. I can't, like, explain it anymore without just giving you the full story. So I highly suggest you go check this out. This book is so cool. It's just so cool.
Now that the first trade's out, I'll definitely have to go pick it up because you made me read issue 1, and I really liked it.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
I'll definitely have to go back.
Yeah, so those were the comic picks. We're going to take a quick break, and we come back. We're going to talk about some stuff, you know. So we'll be back in a moment. So the first thing I want to talk about this week was a PDF of a chapter out of a book called Superhero Comics as Moral Pornography, which sounds, it's a very enticing, almost clickbaity type of thing. But I found it on Twitter, I don't remember, sometime in the last week, and I saved it, and I don't remember who tweeted it, so I feel really bad that I don't remember where I got this from. But nonetheless, I read it. It's like a 17-page article, or I guess PDF. Like I said, it's a chapter out of a book from a bigger book from a series called Our Superheroes Ourselves, which is a psychology book, like looking at the psychology behind superheroes and how we relate to them and so on and so forth. But this specific chapter talked about how, I guess it examines like the fascination with evil characters that we have and understanding what morals these books like superheroes have versus supervillains. And it talks about like the I guess the black and white sides of good versus evil within comic books. And I had a chance to read it, and I asked a couple questions to these guys in the pre-show, and we talked about it a bunch. So what did you guys think of this? I guess that's the first thing I want to say. You know, what did you guys think of this article? Less so the article itself, because we all kind of agreed, I should say, that it was very strangely written, I guess, or like the arguments were strange, but the content was interesting, right?
Yeah.
So what did you guys think about this? Like, what do you think about this idea of superhero comics as moral pornography? What a fucking phrase. What a title.
Well, I mean, it's obviously meant to be provocative. And yeah. I think that's one of the issues I had with it. And I admit I didn't really give the essay itself as close of a read as I maybe should have. But this is a topic I find very interesting as someone who went to school and was trained in philosophy and, you know, moral philosophy is something I've studied, and superheroes is something I love. I've written about the topic of superheroes and morality before. This is a psychology paper as opposed to a philosophical paper, but it's a pretty similar approach. And what I found sort of interesting is the way that the author seemed to simplify the superhero genre, I think in a negative way. You know, it becomes this thing where he says, well, superhero comics are black and white and they always have been. That's not really true.
Right. I think we're far from that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the last 30 years of comics have shown otherwise, you know. Mm-hmm. And also this idea that there's a distinction between superhero comics and other traditional narrative stories. There's always been that idea that superheroes are a type of modern mythology. And I think that simplification has its own problems, but these types of stories about morality plays, about good and bad, about heroes and villains, these have been around for millennia. They've been around as long as people have been telling stories. Mm-hmm. This type of story has been told. Superheroes are just kind of the most recent version of it. And the genre has its own tropes, you know, that pop up over and over again, but you can't simplify those tropes. All these characters are different. Not all supervillains are created equal, you know. Yeah. They all have their own background and different appeal. So,
yeah.
The issue of why this genre and this trope keeps popping up is because I think it's effective. It's a good story, and you can do a lot with it. So the problem of narrowing it down and saying, "Oh, these are the only kinds of stories we can tell with it," that's not true. You know, that's not true. As we see throughout the past, you know, whatever, how long superhero comics have been around. So it's an interesting topic. I think it could be framed and discussed in a more complete and nuanced way.
Yeah, Xander, what is your takeaway from this?
Well, I really liked that it made me think about these things. First off, I really liked where this article was going. I think they talk about popularity of supervillains and popularity of superheroes. And for me, it seemed like they were confusing popularity and enjoyment, saying that basically, I mean, in one specific instance, they were saying how a website made a top 100 comic book villains, and only a year later did they make an equivalent list for superheroes. And I felt like that was a weird kind of making a point off of something maybe more circumstantial than it actually was. I think it made me really, really upset to like read this article and have to like look at all these different things and think about how I view superheroes and supervillains. And I think a lot of people, even in comics, I think Superman is seen as quote unquote boring as a, you know, a superhero because all he does is stand for good and whatever. And I think that's been a topic within comic book series. I think that has been almost like word for word, a dialogue line from like a line of dialogue from some series that I've read. and almost as a response to that, I feel like more superheroes have sort of entered a moral gray area. And maybe that's happened more and more since the popularity of antiheroes, sort of, which were popularized more back in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s, even 2000s.
I think if I can interject here, I think that actually it was kind of surprising that wasn't brought up at all. In the article. Like, they talk, I mean, this article or this chapter, I keep saying article, whatever. We're going to call it an article.
We'll call it an article.
Of simplicity. This article was published around 2013, or at least the book that it was in was published in 2013, and they've cited our other articles and other, you know, pieces of literature up to about 2011. So it's probably safe to say that it was published somewhere around 2011, 2012, maybe 2013. And they didn't bring up antiheroes at all. And I think part of that might have been because they were focusing on, like, the straight line of, you know, good versus evil. But antiheroes play a huge part in comic book culture. So I just wanted to add that to your point, Xander.
Yeah. And I think that has definitely changed how I read, or not necessarily how I read comic book heroes, but the types of comic book heroes that I read. Because I don't read as much Marvel or DC, which is where most of the superhero genre is. And I think that the series I do read are a little bit more centered around heroes as people rather than heroes as the force of good versus evil.
Right.
I think a lot of the superheroes that I end up reading are more, I guess, internally conflicted to the point where when they... I don't know. Looking at the series that I read, a lot of these superheroes are kids or people that have just gotten their powers. And so they're kind of wondering, how do I use these abilities that I have? You know, what is good? What is evil? What should I be doing with the talent and power that I have?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think that's sort of the natural progression, you know, the origin story of a superhero is that search for greater purpose, that sort of, you know, search for your destiny as a hero. And
right.
So I think in some ways the article sort of puts a lot of that aside and like you said, Paul, sort of simplifies everything.
I think the reason they did that was they were trying to get at this idea of, you know, we recognize evil villains for what they are because they have certain traits about them, they do bad things or whatever. And they go on later in the article to say, you know, writers are eventually encouraged, you know, you can't use like supervillains like you would in the black and white films where someone with a big mustache, they're curling or they're, you know, rubbing their hands together to look like an evil person, or, you know, they can't be wearing all black all the time, because that's usually like a dead giveaway, you know, that they are the supervillain or they are the bad guy in the story and they represent quote unquote evil. And when we're getting into this good versus evil argument, I think that this point is brought up in the article, but I don't think it's as discussed as heavily as it should have been. You know, characters aren't necessarily inherently evil in stories, right? This is where the whole gray area that you were talking about, Xander, comes in. Characters aren't doing things for the sake of being evil. They usually have a purpose, like their intent, to go to my favorite supervillain, you know, Dr. Doom, his idea is to, you know, eradicate, you know, to basically control the world because he thinks he has the perfect vision for the universe. I mean, let's look at Secret Wars. That's exactly what that stupid story is. You know, him being in control of everything and saying, I am Doom God. And that's exactly what he wanted, to take over. And there are people trying to stop him because we, as who the people that we recognize or we empathize with, or we see through their eyes, like Reed Richards and his family, they're trying to do what's quote unquote right and good by stopping this person because everyone should have free will. Everyone should be able to make their own choices, whether they're good or bad. No one other person should be able to control you. Whereas Dr. Doom's is the other way around. He says, people are inherently stupid, therefore I should control them because I'm so much better and smarter. Yeah. And he's so great for that. Like, he represents the most awful everything. And that's kind of what the article is getting at, you know, that we see these characters, we go, this is a bad guy, and we get almost like pleasure out of it, to being able to recognize how bad they are, which seems almost contradictory to what you would normally think. Like, you would want to be able to recognize the good traits in people, and you'd say, yeah, that's a good person, thumbs up, Superman, you did the right thing this day.
but knowing that someone's bad and being able to say, no, well, like, that's not something I want in my life, I'm glad that's not happening to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had some questions written down about why do you like supervillains and what are so great about them, but that, at the end of the day, I think that those are simplistic, almost pointless questions. And I think, you know, the better question is what the takeaway that, again, Xander, you brought up is, you know, more characters are becoming gray, or they have, you know, character flaws, or they do one bad thing and they're trying to redeem themselves, or I don't know, something bad happens to him and Superman gets red kryptonite and now he's a bad guy, or something. You know, like, there's all these, you know, these things that make up the character for what they are, because they aren't just this one-dimensional good or one-dimensional bad. This isn't The Hobbit. This isn't, you know, where there's, like, the dragon who's bad because he's a dragon and there's nothing more to say about it.
That the article brought up, though, because going back to that whole, like, list of top 100 comic book villains, they were noting that the Joker, I think, was number one or number two. Like, he was way, way up there.
Right, and of course,
pretty much he has no redeeming qualities as a person.
Right.
I think he's got a lot of, like, there's a huge entertainment factor because he can be very charming, very funny. But at the end of the day, most people who have read any stories with Joker know that he's not a good person and that he does bad things almost constantly. Right. And he can be nice to certain people, but usually when there's just an innocent person, like, he's more likely going to hurt or kill them. And so it was really interesting the way that the article framed that, because they made it seem like people who, in terms of popularity, because Joker was a popular villain, they seemed to be confusing that with people who liked Joker as a character or as a person, right, rather than people who enjoyed what Joker brought to a series because of how bad he was.
Right.
I really like Joker in certain series because he is just completely evil. He is this really twisted person who he'll go to an extreme that Batman won't necessarily be able to follow, you know, or predict.
They can't match him.
Yeah. And I think that's what sort of makes him an interesting villain, because he is a match for the hero.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what is kind of missing from these types of discussions about superheroes and supervillains, sort of separate from story. These characters only exist inside of stories. And once you sort of remove the narrative context, you lose what makes them interesting. So simply saying, I like the Joker. Well, I don't like the Joker. I like stories that feature the Joker. Right? Yeah, that's the point you're trying to make. You know?
Yeah.
And then I feel like the reason that superhero comics in the last 40 or 30 years have become more interesting, quote unquote, or more gray, you know, is because they're stories about the superhero genre itself. Like, all genres and all medium do this, where at a certain point the stories become about the medium and the genre and the tropes that preceded it. Mm-hmm. So that's why something like Invincible is a comic about superhero comics, you know?
Yeah.
So it can make these interesting, it can play with these ideas in a way that maybe the early Superman comics, early Batman comics just didn't, because that wasn't what the writers wanted. And of course, you want, in terms of separating the characters from the story, also thinking in the comic books in terms of a medium. In the 40s and 50s, no one was thinking about these things long term. They were just churning them out to make a profit. It wasn't until the 60s and people started thinking about these comics and these stories in the long term, you know, and sort of writing stories that went on for, you know, 5-6 issues and creating these big long narratives. That's a pretty recent development. And necessarily, the characters, both superheroes and supervillains, in these new types of stories are going to be different from they were in the past.
Yeah. And I mean, just to go back to the Joker, because I know someone in real life who really likes the Joker and likes the Joker, not in the sense that I was talking about, where, like, as a,
it's like a foil, like, to Batman.
Right. Like, not in that way. He just likes Joker. I think at one point I asked him, like, why do you like this guy? And he's like, because he's fucked up. And I'm like, oh, okay, man. Like, okay. And it was like this really uncomfortable moment where I don't know. It made me feel
We've all been 15, though. It's okay.
But it makes me wonder, like, how many people who read comics take pleasure out of these bad things that a villain does? Like, because I think that's how this article was framing it, that we were deriving some weird pleasure off of seeing evil people do evil things. And I think that was my weird, like, my takeaway from it, that it was sort of, in some way, like, this outlet for comic readers of, like, I like seeing this stuff happen, and because I don't see it in real life, I need to see it in a comic book. And I feel like it was sort of this, like, derogatory thing that it was saying towards comic readers in general.
That's kind of the impression I got, too. And I have a big problem with making that sort of hard and fast distinction, saying, like, oh, there's stories and then there's real life. You know, Superman is unrealistic because no one's that good in real life. Well, And this is my personal view. I mean, sorry, but Superman is real. He's a character, an idea that exists in the real world.
Yeah.
You know? So that idea of altruism,
yeah,
that exists.
Yeah, right? For sure.
It's a real thing that people feel, and some people don't feel, and people change their mind about it, but it's a real thing that exists. It's not unrealistic. Not to deviate too much, but have you ever read Superman Secret Identity, the Kurt Busiek story that came out about 10 years ago?
No, I haven't. I've seen it a million times, but I've never read it.
It's so I'm a diehard Superman fan. I understand people's complaints about the character, but I completely disagree. I just love the character.
Whatever.
So much.
All right, let's disregard Paul for the rest of the podcast.
Exactly. I have no idea what I'm talking about. But in that story, you know, the premise is that it's based in the real world, our real world, where Superman is a character in comics and TV and movies, but not quote unquote real.
Hmm.
But there's a kid, he's like 13 years old. His parents named him Clark Kent kind of as like a joke, and he really resents it. But when he turns 13, he discovers he can fly. And he has super strength. But there's no question. He doesn't like think like, oh, should I be a good guy? Should I be a guy? No, it's like, well, no, Superman is a real thing. It's an idea. And if you have these powers, this is what you do. So he just does it.
Oh,
it's like the most realistic take on the character. It's not saying, oh, what if Superman was real? It's like saying, well, no, the idea is real. You know, and I like that idea that these stories have a sort of power and have an influence that you can't say is unrealistic because they're part of our cultural heritage and the zeitgeist, part of our reality.
Yeah. And I think they sort of touched on sort of his, like you said, his altruism, he is that pillar of light, that goodness in the world, right, whether it's in comics or how people perceive him in real life. And they kind of touched on that in Man of Steel a little bit. And I enjoyed that moment where he's like, I am better and I have to be better than, everyone else. Like he has to uphold this moral standard. And I think in comics, that's always how I've seen him. He's always this, this beacon of light. He is like the moral standard. How a lot of people see Captain America as the moral standard in the Marvel universe. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it's just how characters have evolved. Maybe it's how storytelling has evolved, how comics have evolved. But I think a lot of things have become a little bit more gray for characters, whether it is Captain America or whether it is Superman. I think Captain America had this weird sort of gray area. I mean, he's had it over time, but I think for me, the biggest moment was Civil War, where he just kind of separates himself from the rest of the superheroes he was with that he fought alongside and was like, you guys are wrong and this is the moral standard. And so that kind of, I think, separated the new Captain America from the old in the context of that story.
I think that was all of Civil War. It was about
challenging
the common, what people consider to be the common way of doing, or the common right, or whatever you want to call it. Like, what is right versus what is morally
exactly
right.
And I think that his character as sort of that beacon of morality changed, whether it was before that moment, but for me it was that moment where I sort of saw him in a different light. And Superman has evolved similarly over time. I think in the last couple Superman stories, graphic novels that I've read, he's sort of become almost tired of his job as Guardian of Earth, and he just kind of wants to separate himself from it, because as long
Kingdom
as he's
Come
been
does not count.
It does count.
It's but, canon.
But he's sort of just over time become, I don't know, like he doesn't want to have to put up with it anymore. Like he's drained with being the moral standard, and he just kind of wants to remove himself from the situation. And I think that's happened several times over the course of his character, and they've just sort of brought that back as needed. But I think that maybe as a response to antiheroes and, you know, the changing morality within superhero comics, I think it's interesting to see those two characters change.
Totally. So the last question I really want to touch on in this is, do we think that good versus evil will survive, or do we think that it's already gone? Like, is this black and white line between what is good and what is bad, like, is, does it still exist in modern comics, or would you say that it's out the window, it's been gone for a while? Because just to add a little bit of context for myself, I would say that we don't exist in that era anymore, only because usually we have so much backstory for both sides of an argument or both sides of a fight or something. we say, well, Stiltman is just trying to rob a bank because he's not a bad guy. He just needs to feed his family or something. Or in some cases, you know, like MODOK is just a crazy, you know, greedy monster man thing, and he wants to take over the world, so therefore he's evil. You know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, does it vary from character to character, or do we think this is just gone now?
No, I definitely think it varies from character to character. I mean, you can't really say that Darkseid is the same and has the same motivations as Captain Cold. You know what I mean? They're radically different characters. You know, even the big bad guys like, you know, Magneto and Darkseid. I mean, you're talking about different levels of power, you're talking about different motivations and all this. So,
yeah.
I don't think that inherent kernel of good and bad, good and evil, we're never going to stop telling stories about that. The nuance and the detail of the stories may change and get more over time. It might be more gray area, so to speak. But at the end of the day, there's always going to be a desire to see the good guys win, or the, you know, I think that's true.
Yeah, I think with morality becoming less of a hard line and more of a gray area, I think the search for what is good and what is evil is, if anything, stronger, because it's not about dividing things into camps of good and evil. It's about finding degrees of good. What is okay? What evil is okay? And if anything, like, that provides an entirely different point of, do we allow evil if something good comes of it? Do the ends justify the means? That's it's like a whole thing that has been reiterated over the past 10 years of all media.
Right.
But I think that sort of that search for good and evil is, if anything, even stronger than before, because we're trying to figure out what is good.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, I recently read some old back issues from the late 80s that DC had published. You know, Cinder and Ash was the series I'd mentioned. And one thing that struck me when I was reading these was a lot of the house ads in the books were for genre books. I mean, not superhero books, but detective stories, science fiction books, and a lot of licensed properties that DC had at the time, like The Shadow, The Phantom, Flash Gordon. And it really got me thinking that we don't see that type of variety in other genres from the big two publishers, Marvel and DC, as we did in the 80s. Obviously, back then, they were even bigger than they are now. You didn't have as many third or outside publishers publishing and having a big market share. But I feel like that type of focus on genre books has sort of shifted to publishers like Image, Boom, and Dynamite, who either have original content that genre books or the licensed properties that DC and Marvel have sort of given up. Is this a good thing for the industry, or should Marvel and DC try to get back to have more of a variety of books and styles instead of just their licensed characters that they own? I think the market right now kind of fits, but it would be nice to see more genre-influenced books from the big two. Do you guys ever thought about this, or do you have any thoughts about it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, go ahead, Xander. Go ahead, because, I mean, I'll... Yeah, go ahead.
Well... I mean, yeah, because I think just seeing how everything's laid out right now, you kind of know the big two are going to be superhero books. And I mean, while that's cool to have consistency or whatever, you kind of wonder how superheroes are going to shift and change in the future. And maybe they won't. Maybe the big two are so on top of it that they are like controlling the future of superhero comics, and that they know that there is going to be business for them in the future. But I think that as far as unique storytelling, you can, like, I mean, just introducing genre books to different aspects of comics, I mean, there's no real loss there for anybody, except maybe a financial one for the creators right. that are making it. I mean, if you want to take an existing character and then do a specific kind of like genre story like with them, I think that's cool, and I think it maybe provides a new take on characters that you maybe wouldn't see otherwise.
Right. Yeah.
Would you say that that's something like Marvel 1602 or maybe even, you know, Marvel's been doing all these weirdo books with Secret Wars like this 1872 or whatever, which is like a Western where Captain America's the sheriff. It's a Western, but it's like an Elseworld book.
Yeah.
You know, or, and I say Elseworld in like the, you know, it's like a what if. Yeah, that's perfect for in the terms of Marvel. You know, so do you think that is what you're getting at, or are you talking about like just taking, for instance, Paul mentioned this in the pre-show about Silver Surfer being like a sci-fi book starring Silver Surfer, to which I said no, Shia LaBeouf him. And I said that it was a Doctor Who story. They just renamed everything to make it fit for the Marvel Universe because Heralds of Galactus might as well just be Time Lords or reincarnations of the Doctor. But nonetheless, do you think that's what you're getting at, Xander?
Yeah, and I if you were to take, I think, as a superhero, that like a pre-existing superhero, and then do that kind of story with them, I think that's, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Like, I think that provides a different take on a superhero. Or Paul, were you specifically talking about like introducing a new set of characters for a story?
You know, it's very interesting because I see it both ways, and I think what's happening right now is definitely an attempt to have genre books that just use pre-existing characters from the big two. You know, like we're saying, you can do, if you want to do a sci-fi book, you couldn't create a new character or a new series, but you could use pre-existing characters like, you know, the Inhumans or Fantastic Four or Silver Surfer. Mm-hmm. We see it with DC. I think a book like Gotham Academy, which I love dearly, it's not really a superhero book, but it's within the framework of Gotham, so they can kind of bend the rules and sort of have a Batman-related book that is a sort of teenage mystery, sort of cult, occult, you know, story.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's kind of like Gotham by Midnight, too, where it's like a horror.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's in the framework of Gotham.
I think my worry for it is that DC, I feel like the big two don't necessarily know, like they understand superhero comic book readers. They don't necessarily understand comic book readers outside of that. Because I worry that when they introduce a new character, that it's like that they're not into really creating new characters anymore that are outside, you know, the scope of their own universe. I don't think that's really their game, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. I never thought about that. As someone who grew up reading superhero comics, I don't know what it's like not to be interested in superheroes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
right.
I know DC has done this in the past. I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago. They got the rights for a bunch of the pulp heroes, like the Shadow and the Avenger. Green Hornet, and Doc Savage. Wait,
Did they get the rights for that? Was that in a co-effort with Dynamite?
I think it was with Dynamite, because Shadow, Shadow was through Dynamite, at least.
Either way. I just wanted to, you know, put my nerd nose in the middle of this. So.
Just tell me I'm wrong again.
Turn around and fucking attack him.
But it was funny, because you got the sense that they didn't know what to do with them. Like, all right, we have these characters. How are we going to sell the book? Well, I know we'll have him cross over with Batman.
Yeah.
That's all we do is publish Batman books these days, you know? So it's like they just don't understand how to do it. And I think, like you said, Xander, that's a lack of understanding the audience or the market right now in some sense.
And because I think if I were to see two books, brand new, like new intellectual property, new characters, new worlds, and one was published by a big two publisher, and one was published by an independent one or a smaller publisher, I feel like my gut instinct would be to not get the one by the big two publisher.
Yeah.
It's because it's not what, partly it's not what they're known for, but that in itself is a stupid reason not to buy something.
Do you think that's
just because they're not known for it?
Do you think that's a reaction though to the, like, I would say to like the resurgence of like indie creators and like creating new characters outside of the big two. Like,
I think it's partially that, but I think it's partially also I understand how big two publishers handle intellectual property of their writers. I feel like they're a lot more hands on and they're a lot more controlling with the things that they own, whereas a smaller publisher is just going to be like, yeah, like if this is your story, and obviously, you know, the scripts have been submitted and they know what's going to happen for like the first arc or whatever, in the case of Image, let's say, and you know that this is where it's going to go, and you say, yeah, this looks good, make it. Whereas DC would like be checking in right after issue one comes out, and they're like, well, the numbers didn't look good, so we're going to need you to add these things, and there's going to be a crossover with Batman in issue three. And
but does that, are you excluding the idea of the creators publishing books under the Marvel and DC imprints, but under their creator-owned sections like Icon for Marvel or Vertigo for DC? Because if you're excluding those, then yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because then DC wants to publish it under their, you know, umbrella, and Marvel wants to do the same. But with Vertigo and with Icon, those are like independent things.
Yeah, I mean,
those
if are, you wanted know, to publish
separate entities,
if they were going to publish through that, I think it would be slightly different. But yeah, when I mean, like what Paul was saying was like when, like a big two publisher like DC does a genre book, and I think if they were going to expand and do genre books, it might not be through DC proper, it might be through Vertigo, through Icon, through these other, you know, like attached publishers.
Yeah, the imprints. Yeah,
those imprints are not what they used to be, though. I mean, does Icon even exist anymore? I can't name a book that Marvel publishes under that.
I don't think
Brian Michael Bendis like has a new number one every 6 months. Yeah, like
yeah.
I think he's still like, they were publishing Powers. They were, I can name a list, but yeah, they exist. But I think Icon exists to a much lesser extent than Vertigo. I think Vertigo is like its own indie publisher that has the DC money. Is what
basically,
how I see it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting because reading this miniseries Cinder and Ash, I realize that there's no way DC would publish this nowadays. This particular type of story would be done either through Image or Oni, one of those smaller publishers. But then looking at the ads and seeing ads for the Grant Morrison's Animal Man, mm-hmm. I'm thinking, well, that was a book that fell under the general umbrella of DC in the DC universe, but didn't feel anything like the other superhero titles.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And we kind of have that now. I feel like, at least on DC, so that's what I'm familiar with, the current DCU branding that mm-hmm. they have, it seems to be aiming at that, but I don't know if it goes far enough. You know, I just don't see the type of variety that you used to see 30 years ago.
I absolutely agree.
Maybe that variety has just shifted to smaller publishers, which is fine.
I think creators want to be able to own the stuff that they create too. That's the other
big shift right now.
Obviously, you know, we've talked about this before. Brian K. Vaughan's Runaways was like the last original thing that he created at the big two. Miss Marvel is probably the newest. Miss Marvel and Miles Morales are probably the only two new characters that have had any major placement in the Marvel universe, you know? And I, of course, big Marvel guy here. I read an article from Chris Claremont who says he refuses to create X-Men anymore simply because they will be owned by Marvel, but also they'll be owned by Fox. Yeah. So he doesn't want to give any more fuel to that fire. So you know, when you read the Nightcrawler book, all of the powered people, they're not inhumans. Oh, they're just people with powers. They're not mutants, you know. it's really funny reading that book rereading that book. I guess if I were to go back, I would probably giggle every issue, because there are powered people all over the place, and he only created two new mutants in that whole series. So it's funny to say the least. I mean, like, if you want to write an X-Men story, you want to do it. If you have to create a character, then so be it. But I think if Grant Morrison wanted to create the stories that he wrote for New X-Men, and he knew that he could probably do something similar at like Image or elsewhere, he probably would have done so. Because I mean, those books, that series did not fit in the greater Marvel universe. And I know that was at a time that they were trying to like go crazy with batshit stories, but like, it's bizarre.
I know that this is just grabbing the tangent and then diving even deeper, but
dive.
Here we go. The
10,000 leagues, man. Let's go.
I feel like no new characters being created is like speaks a lot to like mutation within the universe a lot, because it's like essentially stopped happening. Like there are no new mutants, and also I think it speaks a lot to like lab safety. Because there are no more lab accidents that cause superheroes to like to just appear. Like,
I wasn't sure what you were getting at, and then it clicked into my head. Thank you.
That's great.
Like, way to go, people of the Marvel Universe, for being better with your lab-controlled systems. No more mutant rats. No more gamma bombs just going off.
But I think that creator-owned like creators wanting to own their content is a huge part of that. And so I don't think DC or Marvel are necessarily going to churn out anything like an original genre story.
Unless the editors, unless Marvel on high comes down to a creator and says, hey, I want you to do this.
Yeah, if they think that it's going to be like financially viable, if it's going to turn a profit, I think they'll do it. Yeah. But until they see that as something that will make them money, I don't think that's we're going to see that at all.
Yeah, which is kind of a shame, because you think about it, that period that I'm talking about, the late 80s, is when the big experiments in the medium were taking place at the big two.
Yeah,
totally, you know, totally.
That's how Watchmen exists. Watchmen was supposed to be a book that featured licensed characters that DC had just purchased the rights to. They got cold feet and just Alan Moore just created analogs for them, mm-hmm. you know, to tell the same story. But you're not going to see a story of that level maybe again, because of this focus on the pre-existing characters that they have.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's something that only time will tell. Simply because at the end of the day, doesn't it seem like we'll eventually get burnt out again?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
This is like the 90s all over again.
2018,
this is, in a way,
2018 is the end of like all of the superhero movies, right?
That we know
we're
going
to be totally burned out by then. No more superhero comics. It's all just going to be like creator-owned genre stories, right?
I don't think it's going to be that far. But I think what I'm getting at is what I foresee happening is maybe, you know, 10 years from now, if maybe less, we'll have this problem where people will be like, all right, I'm done with Wolverine stories. I need something new. I need, you know, I don't want another Captain America story. I need something new. And I think that's why Marvel's changing up these roles. You know, they're yeah. using these characters as mantles at this point. You know, Thor is a mantle. Mm-hmm. Wolverine is a mantle. Captain America is a mantle. Spider-Man is a mantle.
Yeah.
All of these things to say, hey, look, it's the same character, but it's a completely different take because of X.
Right.
Rather than trying to create new characters, you know, having 1,000 new Spider-Men, let's just have the two and say we're just going to swap people out inside of those mantles.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right answer, but I think it's them trying to keep things, you know, obviously, you know, new and interesting, but not getting rid of or creating anything new so that they don't have to manage something else and have new rights for a new intellectual property. Maybe that's yeah. lazy. Maybe it's them trying to be financially conservative. Who knows?
Maybe they're brilliant.
But it ultimately sounds like this comes down to money, right? Do you guys think that that's what it is?
I think that's what it is, yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. That's the answer. Goodbye. No. But that's unfortunate, right?
For sure.
Absolutely.
We run out of... I mean, and DC tried this with the New 52. Nick has told us time and time again, and I only say that because, like, he does tell me... He does say this quite a bit, but, you know, they tried things with, you know, All-Star Western. They tried things with... that's the only book I can think of. But
well, it's like, you know, it's like all those times when we've gone to C2E2, Mike, and you and I have sat in the Marvel panel, and they just yep. say, we make these stories because you buy them. And I think it you know, it goes to yep. to voting with your dollar, and people will just keep buying whatever they make, and so they'll just keep making that. And I think either they're just gonna keep making these stories, and because people keep buying them, or at some point everyone is going to burn out, and there's yeah. gonna be maybe it won't be a huge shift, but there it will be a shift, and yeah. it will eventually happen.
But to keep this conversation going, because I've just got so many more questions. So at what point, though, do we say, okay, I want to buy my Superman story, but I also want to buy something new? How do you, you know, that's the question that I don't think anyone has the answer to here in this trio of conversation. But it's still the question that is, I think, valuable to say, I want to buy Superman, but I also want to try something that isn't Superman and isn't what I expect out of DC. I want to try something that you sure. guys created that is original and just as exciting. You know, how do you guys think we could you speak up to DC and say, I want that?
I mean, like, write to creators. Write to publishers, write to editors, and say, hey, this is what I want. And I think not enough people do that. I think maybe more people do it on social media. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's yeah. heated is something else entirely. But I think that there's definitely ways. I mean, I think now with social media being what it is, people being able to contact creators, people being able to speak with creators mm-hmm. is way more prevalent than it was 10 even 5 years ago. And so I
yeah,
think
totally.
I think the creators that participate in social media, that are sort of on the ball in terms of communications yeah. with their readers, they understand how readership is changing, and they know what kind of stories they want to tell and what stories people are wanting to read.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to not just voting with your dollars, which of course is something you kind of always have to do. But like you said, that interaction with the creative side and fans is easier than it ever has been. And we've seen it work before. I don't think it's any coincidence that Marvel did not announce a new solo Black Panther title right away. And then after a few weeks of hubbub on social media, they suddenly announced a new Black Panther solo title. I hate to be cynical, but I don't think that's a coincidence.
Yeah.
So being vocal about that is great. And, you know, I would suggest if you just want to read something new, probably there are thousands of stories you haven't read just waiting in the back issue bins at your local shop.
Yeah.
You know, just dive in and try to find something.
And do note that they will probably be a little bit
a little dated.
that's a better way to say it. On the whole, though, there are still some very, very good series that exist back there. I mean, in those bargain bins, in those old trade paperbacks, in those classic titles from the 70s, 80s, 90s. Maybe not so much the 90s, but. So cool, yeah. So, but genre books. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily read too many genre books, but maybe I should try. I guess, you know, I just read my X-Men and read my Marvel books, or read my indie books that are all the same. So who cares?
Not genre books.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That definition of genre book seems weird to me because I never really think of books like that. I think of an interesting story, and I realize I'm tangenting, just continuing this, but this is.
Yeah,
it was in my mind, man. So,
think about this. Like, what if they did? What if they took Superman and made a detective story? Like, what if they did that? What if it was crime, like crime pulp Superman?
But like, he just uses X-ray vision to figure everything out.
Okay. Well, then maybe not Superman. Maybe you do it with a different character. Well, but like that's an example of how you could do it.
I mean, that's another example. I mean, you don't. I think it speaks to a lack of offering, because that used to happen. We don't see DC doing Elseworld stories anymore. You don't see these sort of weird limited series that they used to do, or these prestige books that used to come out in the late 80s and 90s. When I was starting to read comics, Elseworlds that was just getting started, and it was really exciting as a fan to just read these different takes on the characters.
Yeah.
I kind of miss that. I miss that being a regular offering from the big two. Even a book like Gotham Central, which is only maybe 7 years old at this point, was an example of using the characters in a genre way that felt different enough from the rest of the universe that you can enjoy it on its own.
And like, you know, 1602 was a good example from Marvel. Even in Marvel Noir, I loved taking those characters and
that
you
was
know,
so put, fun.
Yeah, like that was such a cool take on those characters. Such a like not only like visually, but you take those characters and then you throw them into that time period and you say, how would this character react? Would they even be the same character? So everybody knows, you know, from movies, from comic books, whatever, everyone has a sense of who Peter Parker is. But you look at Peter Parker in Spider-Man Noir and you realize this is a different guy entirely. Yeah,
totally.
And he is willing to go to different extremes in order to do the things he has to do as Spider-Man.
Right.
And it's like, it's those interesting different viewpoints and different takes on characters that I feel like genre books are like perfectly positioned to be able to do. And we just don't see as much of them as we should.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of alarming. It's alarming to see the variety and risks that publishers took only 30, 25 years ago just to kind of see it not exist anymore.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. Produced by Mike Rappin, and produced and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Just Blaze, Zion Eye and the Grouch, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep up with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, we'd love it if you would take a quick moment to rate us. If you'd like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter @destroythecyb or follow us on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
And believe me, I was really biting my tongue. I was going to go into a whole rant about wrestling and good and bad in wrestling. That's why wrestling's so great, because that's all it is.
You should bring this up on your other podcast, man.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, sure.
I mean, no joke. I really hope that you can, because that's super. That'd be super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. No. Paul. Someone made a. Oh. Max Landis, who wrote Chronicle. He made a video about.
John Cena.
John Cena.
Oh, it was so good.
he made a video about it. I watched most of it.
Did I send that to you, Paul?
You know what? That's popped up. I haven't watched it yet, just because I find Max Landis totally unbearable.
Fuck you, man. Max Landis is a fucking god.
I like his style of video, because it's engaging, and I think it seems
super personable.
But I totally understand how it's almost abrasive at how like fast paced and in your face it is, because it's like new media, you know, kind of YouTube bullshit. But
also he's like he's on the ball.
I don't know. He did that one about the death of Superman that I watched, and it was unbearable.
Oh,
just,
man.
His personality and just the points he was making shallow. I'm just like, this is kind of... So I've definitely heard a lot of... Even my wrestling friends have been raving about the wrestling thing he did.
Okay. Yeah.
But I can't get past him
as a person.
To enjoy it.
Yeah. I will say, after watching that video, it like really piqued my interest even further. Like, I am seriously on the cusp constantly of like just fucking diving into wrestling head on.
But
I'm like every time, like, it, there's enough time between every time we talk about it that like if I am a glass of water and it's filled up to the brim after talking, like it evaporates out a little bit, like it evaporates on like halfway, and then I talk to you again. I'm like, oh man, wrestling sounds so fucking cool, and then I get to the brink and I'm like, yeah, wrestling, and then comic books happen. And I'm like, all right, and then the water evaporates out again. It's something's gonna push me over the edge. Is all
sure.
It's gonna happen eventually.
I think it's gonna be like, listen, I'm gonna listen to your podcast, Paul, and I'm just like, fuck it, wrestling's my life now.
For me, it. Like yep. I used to watch WWE. One of my friends in elementary school was way into it, and I freaking loved The Rock back in the day.
You still love The Rock?
Love The Rock. Freaking Dwayne Johnson.
Who doesn't love The Rock?
Yeah, no, he's the man. But like that was my whole deal, was The Rock and like Kane.
Sure.
who was not great, but you know, whatever. No. He was cool. He had a mask. But I like that was like my whole deal with wrestling. Like at the time, it was just like I was sold on like a handful of characters, a handful of people, and I was like, that's it. That's all I needed.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, like I kind of fell out when a bunch of characters left. A bunch of people stopped and did whatever. Because I don't know where those people go. They either do movies and then become actors, or
you're Mick Foley.
Yeah. Mick Foley just pop all the time. Well, Joel, you'd be glad to know that Kane is still employed. He still has matches.
Oh my god, he's so old now.
Yeah, he's not very good. But they gave him. They basically took a management position in the company, so he comes out and wrestles. He doesn't have a mask, but he wrestles in like. Wearing slacks and dress shoes.
Like Vince McMahon used weird. To do.
Oh, yeah, it's man. The dumbest thing.
That's so stupid.
It's pretty
I wish
stupid.
You had just told me he died.
It would be great if you told Xander he died and Xander gets back into wrestling, then fucking Kane shows up. Yeah, and he's like, oh my god.
He's alive. It's like The Undertaker.
There's definitely something to that, because I was watching, you know, last week there's a big pay-per-view and it was pretty mediocre. It was kind of dumb. I'm like, yeah, this really isn't very exciting. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden the lights go out and you hear The Undertaker's like gong. And like everyone I was with,
we all started screaming. Like,
yeah.
Oh,
you know,
shit.
Just that sound and just seeing him. Even though he can't wrestle that well anymore, just the idea
of that character is so him being back. My friend was the guy, my friend who I watched it with, he was super into
I'll
the
right
Undertaker.
Back, guys.
Sure.
I guess that was like almost 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Like, oh man. Yeah, he was super into The Undertaker, and I was really into The Rock. I'm trying to think of who else was like current at the time.
Well, I mean, Stone Big Cold Show. Was like the biggest guy. Yeah.
Big yeah, Show. I guess. Yeah, Stone Cold.
Mankind.
Yeah. Gosh. I've forgotten more about that than I ever.
It's interesting now because there's so much more variety. You know, most of the stuff I watch is the Japanese stuff. And it's the same thing with comics. Like I was saying, like, comics are now about comics. Uh-huh. Like, I can watch wrestling and appreciate it as an art form as well, as even more so than just the story, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm watching what's more in the backstage stuff and how it's put together.
Yeah.
Then sometimes the matches themselves, so.
Well, it's like once you get into any medium, whether it's comic books, video games, wrestling, like, once you're into it enough, it's like, there's got to be more. And then you start, like, seeing, like, the making of and, like, all these things behind the scenes, and you appreciate it. Like, the, what was it? Someone was showing, I saw a behind-the-scenes thing for, I think it was, like, Dwayne Johnson went behind the scenes of WWE and showed, like, a lot of the prep. And, like, like, routines and exercises that they all did to, like, stay in shape and also, like, prepare for these matches. And it made me appreciate it on a level that I don't think I ever understood fully when I was actually watching it.
Right,
That, like, I didn't really understand, like, how much work went into it.
Yeah, it's always fascinating to see that. And then hearing, you know, wrestlers talk about, especially the older guys, where it was presented as being more real, like in the lengths they went to preserve that, you know?
Yeah.
It always makes me wish I could go back and, like, watch that stuff without the knowledge of it, you know? To kind of remove the context almost and just kind of appreciate it as just a story of, here's a guy I like and here's a guy I don't. I want to see them kick each other's ass. You know, when it comes out to that's the most basic story there is. So when you get a point when you can kind of suspend disbelief and just get back to that, it can be a lot of fun. So
yeah, and I bet that, like, not having any context for it, because I sort of have a framework of understanding for WWE, I bet if I just, like, launched myself into Japanese wrestling, that it would just be, like, just let it wash over me.
Yeah. It's actually kind of fascinating, because I started watching it, and, like, you know, I'm watching it, there's no English commentary, you just have the Japanese commentary.
So you just watch
it. I'm just watching it, so I'm not worried about the behind the scenes stuff. I'm just watching the match and watching what they're doing in the ring and the story they're telling. And even then, with the language barrier, I can still tell, oh, this guy's the bad guy and this guy's the hero. Way that they move and the way that they act.
Oh,
so
cool. That's so cool. Like,
it's kind of neat.
That's such a wonderful thing. Like,
well, it's like stage performance. I mean, it is physical. Exactly. It is a physical performance.
It's like old opera or something. Like, where the bad, like I said, you know, the bad guy's twisted his fucking mustache to be obvious that he's the bad guy.
That's just a sign for
shit.
Yeah,
Paul, I'm gonna fucking dive into. I'm gonna dive in, Paul. It's gonna be too late. I'm
yes. when I'm there, we're gonna watch some New Japan.
Do it. And
the G1 climax is going
you,
on.
So. I am. All
you're gonna
for
pull
that.
Him. You're gonna pull him into it, Paul. Do
that's
it.
Gonna yes. be. That's gonna spill the cup over, and then it's gonna be it for me.
Yep.
It was like when I threw myself into Ninja Warrior. Like, right before that got, like, super popular here, I found my cousins
before
in Japan.
Before it was cool.
No, well, my cousins in Japan sent me, like, links to this stuff, because, like, they were super into it at the time, and I, like, not knowing what the announcers were saying, I'm, like, watching these people compete, and I think there's something universal about, like, the physicality of, like, physical performance, physical competition that transcends... Yeah. All languages, all cultures, where you just kind of like, I understand this.
That's beautiful.
It's true. Absolutely.